Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Laura Bischoff is state government reporter for Dayton Daily News. Welcome back, Laura.
Hello.
Andy Chow is a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Andy.
Good morning.
And Jeremy Pelzer covers politics for Cleveland.com. Welcome back.
Hi, happy Monday.
Okay, so where do we even begin? A lot of people have heard now about how Ohio's juvenile prisoners report the highest rate of sexual victimization in the nation. It's a report, or it was from a survey from the U.S. Department of Justice. What gives? It seems like juvenile justice issues, and particularly juvenile prison issues, are almost a routine thing problem in Ohio now.
So, you know, this was based on 2018 data, and it defines sexual victimization as forced or coerced sexual acts while in juvenile detention. Ohio's rate was 15%. And they only got data from two of six DYS facilities. The national rate was 7.1%. The good news is that in 2012, Ohio's rate was 19.8%, and the U.S. rate then was 9.5%. So it is going down. They did say there were a lot of caveats with the data. I think nationwide they surveyed 330 facilities, but only 113 had enough data in order to draw conclusions. And also, Ohio required the researchers to go track down permission from the guardians of the
victims.
Yeah, the people. And so that made it harder for them to actually get permission to talk to Ohio's youths who are in detention.
But I'm just going to venture a guess that that's probably the same kind of problem in every state.
No, not every state required guardians to track down, or the researchers to get the permission from
the
guardians.
So that could skew the results, too.
Could.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the first problem that the Department of Youth Services have had in Ohio. Until 2015, the system was under federal monitoring because they were they had found things like improper use of force, not enough staff, and so it's interesting, you know, now that they got out of that in 2015, but now. They did a survey like this back in 2012, and Ohio also scored poorly in terms of sexual victims. And so what the DYS is, one of their explanations for this is, well, we're actually better than we were last survey.
Yeah.
So we're still bad. And then they also say, as Laura mentioned, that it wasn't enough people to really be a meaningful gauge.
Right.
Yeah, a few years ago, you know, I think it was when the last report that Jeremy just mentioned came out, the Department of Youth Services had this huge meeting where they brought a lot of interested parties together, people who advocate for the system and advocate for different parts of the system, to sort of all sit down and talk about what are the issues when it comes to the juvenile justice system, what are the issues to prevent people from having these problems to begin with, to even go into the system, to help the people who are coming out of the system. And I think one of the big takeaways they had, and you find this a lot with a lot of larger government entities, is that a lot of people seem to think that the Department of Youth Services had a lot of silos up, where you have one agency sort of in its own corner doing one thing, another part of the agency in another corner doing another thing, and there wasn't a lot of communication mm-hmm. to talk about what are the big issues that are going on. And so for the past couple of years now, I think they've been trying to break down those silos to improve communication, to figure out, to pinpoint what the problems are, to take a magnifying glass to the problem to really figure out what's going on and how to fix it. And I think maybe the state might say that the reduced numbers might be a reflection of what they're working towards, but still, they're not good numbers.
Hmm. They're saying things like they're going to do things like better staff to juvenile ratio. They're building more individual bathrooms instead of like group bathrooms. Mm-hmm. They're like more compartmentalizing the juveniles that they're looking over.
There's also been an overall trend over the last 10, 15 years of, you know, not having as many kids held within DYS detention facilities.
Right.
They've closed more than half of the facilities that were across the state.
So does that mean there's a shortage or they don't need them?
Well, I think that kids who are adjudicated through the juvenile justice system are largely held or punished within community settings. And so the kids who do end up at Ohio DYS facilities are, you know, probably the most problematic.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We've been talking about a report. It was a survey from the U.S. Department of Justice, and it showed, although it may be flawed, that Ohio's juvenile prisoners report the highest rate of sexual victimization in the nation. All right, Ohio lawmakers have been busy in the Ohio General Assembly. That ban on a ban, ban on the plastic ban, local plastic bans, did pass the House. It's possible. I mean, what are its chances in the Senate? And then furthermore, what about the governor, who's saying he seems like a little bit of a champion for local governments for a change?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the chances in the Senate are really good because there's a similar plastic ban bill. Say that five times fast. pending in the Senate. So it kind of boils down to what it's a local control issue. The Ohio Municipal League and a lot of the local governments against this. Environmental groups are against it. Places that have there. I think there's like eight states across the country that have instituted statewide bans on plastic grocery bags or just imposing a fee, and it changes consumers' behavior. There's 22 million pounds of plastic in the Great Lakes each year, so I mean it's obviously a problem for our region. But Larry Householder, the Speaker of the House, said that he doesn't favor a statewide ban. This is actually a bill that ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, has promoted, and I think it's been adopted in 14 other states, which would preempt local governments from putting fees or bans on, what do they call it, auxiliary containers?
Single-use.
It's grocery bags, plastic cups, etc.
And this is also one of those issues that kind of comes up. Somebody introduces it as a bill, and then everybody else is looking around saying, what's going on here? Who's asking for this? This seems to be looking for a problem where there is none. I think when it was first introduced, I don't think any local government had even implemented a ban on plastic bags.
It was preemptive.
Yeah. And I think now that we've chugged along, I think there are a few local entities that have implemented some sort of fee.
Cuyahoga County, without the participation of Cleveland, or at least not guaranteed, and also Bexley.
Bexley. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I guess right now, when it comes to these local government control bills, it does seem to be somebody in the state legislature, members of the legislature, sort of doing something preemptive, where they have concerns that a local government will go and try to do something, so they try to nip it in the bud right away. I'm not sure how much political will there is in the Senate at this point. We tried to ask Senate President Larry Opoff about it after the House had passed it, and he said, you know, he gave us kind of the boilerplate answer of, well, we'll look into it. We'll have our caucus look into it. We asked if there was a lot of support among the Republican members of the Senate, and he didn't seem to. I don't think he answered that. So we're not really sure how much support there is in the Senate yet.
But notably, as I mentioned, Governor DeWine is not only taking on the issue and saying this doesn't think it's a good idea. He's focusing on the issue of local control. Mm-hmm. Laura Bischoff, it's been a while since we've had anybody.
Yeah,
in
I think that the governor has kind of pledged to be more of a partner for local governments. I think that a lot of the local governments were not happy with how John Kasich operated. Right out of the gate, he cut the local government fund pretty significantly, and they felt like, between that and red light cameras and other issues, that they just didn't have any real say. I think that Governor DeWine is kind of changing direction in that regard. Mm.
Do you think he's going to? It's just interesting to see this. I'm wondering about how it could affect successes with the Ohio General Assembly going forward, Jeremy.
I don't think this is a do-or-die bill for him in the legislature. I think I don't know if it may well have this the support in the legislature to even have the votes to override it. Uh-huh. So, I mean, DeWine's smart enough that he's not going to go to battle if he knows he's not going to win. He's more of a work behind the scenes guy and try to have something worked out before it comes up in the public.
But Anne, like you said, this is sort of in keeping with a larger trend with the governor. When he was asked about the opioid lawsuit and the fight over settlement funds and if it should go to the state or if it should go directly to the local governments, when there was a thought that there might be a bill that would sort of keep it from the local governments and go have it go all the way to the state, he said that would be a mistake. He said it would be a mistake to leave the local governments and local prosecutors out of it. When he was asked about this bill, I think he used the same language. I think he said it would be a mistake take over, to go over the heads of local government. So I think that's something, that's a theme that I think he's going to stick to for a while now.
Now, speaking of that, the opioid lawsuit and that issue, Ohio voters could decide a constitutional amendment to split up opioid lawsuit cash. The plan is being put forward by Attorney General Dave Yost. What does he want?
Well,
Jeremy Pelzer?
First of all, it's dead.
All of the obstacles that he would have to overcome. But we knew that before he proposed this. He'd been putting something out there before. He'd been talking about it before.
Well, what this is
he seems to keep pressing forward with
this,
it.
This is kind of a no win. I'm having trouble trying to see what the win is here for Dave Yost. What this bill, what his attempt would be, is he came kind of out of the blue last second and he's told lawmakers, hey, before you guys leave for the end of the year in a week and a half, if you guys could put this constitutional amendment on the ballot, that would create sort of a locked box. So basically create this state fund that would get a big portion of all the opioid settlement money, and then this fund would distribute it among all the local governments. Well, lawmakers were like, well, no, we're going to leave for Christmas. Like, we're not going to pass this in time. And so,
why is that a deadline? Why does it have to be done by December 18th?
That's the deadline to make the March primary ballot.
Yeah, okay.
It has to be done 90 days before the March primary.
And this, it's so interesting to me because Yost and One Fell Swoop has angered both lawmakers, like all the opioid local government folks who he's been negotiating with about how to deal with the settlement money. The governor's not happy about it. The governor said this would be, or a spokesman said it would be premature. So in one fell swoop, it was a long shot to begin with. So I'm having trouble understanding why he's doing this.
Well, so when the attorney general put out the statement and the memo talking about putting this into a constitutional amendment, he said that this was actually sort of an olive branch. So, like, I guess taking a step back, the attorney general has been fighting for whatever funds to come from an opioid lawsuit settlement to go to the state and then be divvied up from the state down to the local governments, whereas the local governments have basically been fighting for the money to go directly to them. So that's where the rub is here. When Yost put out this proposal to do a constitutional amendment, he sort of described it as an olive branch to the local government, saying, this is my pledge to you that it will go down to the local governments. And when you read,
except for what part,
what's that,
the state gets and what
exactly
part,
yeah. Yeah, it did, it the way it specified some things, it did spell out how the money should be going mostly to the state, to the local governments, but it did spell out a portion that would stay on the state level. It also spelled out a portion that would then be invested so you could continue the fund in the long term,
in perpetuity. Yeah.
He pointed out that Oklahoma during and we should all mention that this is sort of in response to the tobacco lawsuit, where the state has no more money from the tobacco lawsuit. But Yost says that Oklahoma did a similar plan to what he's proposing, and Oklahoma still has money from the tobacco settlement. So if you were to ask Attorney General Yost, he would say that the proposal he's laying out is sort of a compromise as a result of this debate that he's been having with local governments.
You know, when I said that he's coming out again asking, you know, wanting to get control or changing who has control of the money, what I was referring to is at first he wanted to get control of the lawsuit.
Correct.
In the 11th hour, and thereby control, I think it was something like 20% of the proceeds from it, from the settlement. That failed miserably. And so this is, now he's coming back with this proposed constitutional amendment to divvy up the money.
You know, the overarching theme in all of this is, like, who's going to control this money? People see a big, big pot of money coming, and the question is, you know, do local governments handle it? Does the state handle it? I think John Kasich and Gordon Gee had a plan that the hospitals would have a hand in it. So, and the question is, when the money comes in, Should there be an overarching theme for how it's used? Should it just be dedicated to addressing the opioid crisis? Is it going to get diverted into, you know, filling potholes and snowplows, or is it going to be, you know, directed to address the crisis, which is continuing to this day and morphing
and,
as well?
And it's different than the tobacco settlement money in that there is an active ongoing crisis, whereas the tobacco settlement mostly was about education and cessation.
I would venture that there is still a huge tobacco addiction crisis going on.
There is. It dipped
right
because they were doing so much public education with the money, and then they stopped. They ran out of money.
Right, and Ohio still doesn't dedicate
a lot of it.
They diverted a lot of it, right.
Right, and I think Ohio gave up on its last funding stream from that. They just decided to securitize in the Strickland administration. You remember they had a budget crisis, and they decided to...
I would also add, not to diminish the effect that tobacco has had on the state, but there are a lot of resources that are put into the opioid epidemic, from treatment to recovery to law enforcement. And there's all sorts of moving parts that are still going on with the opioid epidemic.
Because of the criminalized nature of it, and unlike tobacco, which is not criminalized.
Right. I mean, nicotine and opiates are ridiculously addictive.
Right.
And
one's
nicotine
and one
will kill
legal.
You slowly, and opioids will kill you fast.
Right.
And where we go from here is Yost's office and local governments are still negotiating about what to do. And they've been holding a bunch of meetings. And yeah, Laura's absolutely right. This is about, they see a lot, like millions upon millions of dollars coming.
Yeah.
And people are, it's a, what do we do with this, and who has control over deciding what to do?
And I want to add something else to this. So if you talk to Yost in his office, he'll argue that in January, I believe, is the next big opioid case in New York, where the state of New York is going to go up against these drug manufacturers and distributors. And he says because of the spotlight coming on to that trial, then a lot of companies are going to want to start settling before that case starts. So Heath says that there's a time frame coming up within the next month where a lot of groups and companies are going to want to settle. And he says that if the state, along with the local partners, send out a plan to say, this is our plan with the money, this is what we plan to do with it, then a judge is more likely to accept the outcome of the settlement because it'll show that the state, along with the local governments, are ready to use the money the right way right away.
We are going to take a quick break. We'll be back with our weekly reporter roundtable. Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. With us today, Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. So we've talked about the ban on the plastic bag ban that's moving its way through General Assembly. We've talked about the incidents of sexual victimization in Ohio's juvenile prisons, reported to be the highest in the country, according to a report from the U.S. Department of Justice. We've also talked about the opioid lawsuit settlement money and who gets it and when, which is the big answer right now is nobody knows. gun violence in Ohio. Big deal back in August after the mass shooting in Dayton and also the one in El Paso over the same weekend. Laura Bischoff, where are we now?
Well, the governor has been pushing this strong Ohio bill that Matt Dolan is carrying in the Ohio Senate. Ohio gun owners and the Everytown, which are like kind of the polar opposites of the gun issue, neither of them like the bill. Meanwhile, there's stand your ground bills in both chambers, the House and the Senate. The governor has said that he wants to deal with strong Ohio first. And there's, you know, I think that this is going to be one of those unfinished items. He's going to close out 2019 without really having a lot of traction on it, and it's something that the governor's going to have to work on.
Another year left in the session, though.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have a story in today's paper about how, you know, gun violence goes well beyond the mass shootings that grab all the headlines. In the 12 hours before the Dayton mass shooting, that same day, there was a guy named Craig Courtner III who was gunned down in Dayton, and there was no massive vigil for him or a multi-million-dollar fund for his family or pledges from politicians or national media or massive celebrity block club party. None of that happened, and none of that happened for anybody else who's died by gun violence in Ohio, but there's certainly been a lot of them. And I think there's a lot of different bills pending. I think the Strong Ohio has a chance of passing, but I think it'll probably be amended quite a bit before it reaches the governor's desk.
Governor told me this is going to be his number one priority next year.
Well, how's that going to manifest?
It's going to have to change. And when I asked him, you know, are you willing to bend on this? He kind of was like, well, you know, we'll see. We'll That indicates to me, like, yeah, this is going to go through a lot of iterations. It's interesting because the bill that he introduced was already like this was supposed to be the pragmatic bill that could make it through. And now he is seeing or perhaps he even saw before that it's not going to pass as is. And it's just going to be further amended and probably watered down even more.
The pro-gun control groups are a little worried that it'll get watered down. They're not happy with it now because it's not strong enough in their view. And they're worried that it's going to get watered down further, and then it's going to be a one and done. It's kind of like, oh, okay, well, we addressed it. We're all done. And then the issues continue, and there's no further advancement on it. And the thing is that, you know, the Ohio legislature is controlled by ardent supporters of the Second Amendment. And until there's really a dramatic change in how the districts are drawn, I think that's just going to continue.
Rural Republicans.
The point being that most Ohioans, a vast majority of Ohioans, support limits on gun ownership.
Sure. There's like all the polls show that there's at least 90-95% support universal gun background checks. And that is something that the governor said right after the Dayton shooting that he was going to ask the lawmakers to do, is to do a universal background check. And what is in Strong Ohio is actually more like a voluntary state level check between private party sales, so that if I'm going to sell you my gun, I go ahead and get you, we get a background check done on you voluntarily, and then you have your little certificate saying that you are legally allowed to purchase a handgun or a long gun or whatever. And then I'm out of that excuses me from any liability for any bad things you might do with that weapon.
Yeah, it makes it easier to get a background check for these personal transfers, but it by no means actually requires it to happen. It doesn't add that the strength of enforcement of requiring a background check to happen for these online sales and for these gun sales, gun show sales. And then you have Ohioans for Gun Safety, who they were collecting signatures to maybe put an issue on the ballot in this coming November, which would basically call for universal background checks.
But they've changed the timing on that.
And
now
they're changing it to,
because they don't have the signatures.
They just don't have it. So now they're, instead of aiming for 2020, they always had the option of aiming for 2021, and that's what they're going to do now. So instead of turning in the signatures this week, which I think they were thinking of doing, now they're going to hold off for another year, keep collecting signatures throughout next year, and then aim to put it on the ballot by 2021.
I've started to see something I've never seen before, and that is signs in people's yards. about guns.
Mm-hmm. Do something or
do something. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Actually, that's a, I think Nan Whaley, the mayor of Dayton, and Peggy Lehner, who's a state senator from Kettering over in the Dayton area, they started a campaign. I think they started to distribute those signs.
And so the thing here is, I think there's a lot of people who support the call to do something, but then when it actually comes down to exactly what is that, there's a debate among gun rights people and gun control people of, is that too harsh of regulation or is that regulation not strong enough? And then when it comes to actually doing the thing that people are calling legislators to do, what is it and where do we land? Like Jeremy said, you know, and what Laura just said, when the Dayton shooting happened 2 days later, Governor Mike DeWine seemed to signal that he was calling for something very similar to red flag confiscation laws and universal background checks. But then through the bill making process of actually coming up with a draft, it got watered down to what it is now because DeWine wants to make a bill that can actually pass the legislature.
But now, does anything significant?
Right. I mean, maybe not. But even as the bill stands now, it might not pass the legislature.
Right.
You know, what's interesting is that because Ohio has the right to do citizen-initiated statutes and constitutional amendments, a lot of major public policy changes, because the legislature is resistant to those changes, come through the ballot. If you look at, like, payday lending reforms.
Mm-hmm. Medical marijuana,
casino gambling, mm-hmm. Tying the minimum wage to inflation, gay marriage ban, like all of this stuff has
smoking
been divided,
ban.
Indoor smoking mm-hmm. ban. A lot of these things have been decided through the ballot. And I think that eventually they'll collect enough signatures to put gun background checks on the ballot in 2021. Mm-hmm. And then I think that's how we'll see gun changes.
Because that legislature will then do something so that.
So the legislature has when you put up a citizen-initiated statute, you collect your first batch of signatures, which I think is like 135,000 signatures.
A lower bar.
Still significant. You got to get them from 44 of 88 counties. Mm-hmm. And then you present the proposed law to the legislature, which can ignore it, amend it and pass it, or pass it. And if they amend and pass or ignore, then the group has the option to go back and get another 135,000 signatures, unique signatures. You have to be from new people. And then it goes to the ballot. And then they have to also raise all the money to campaign for that. And it's a pretty high bar, but it is something that can be reached and has been in the past.
There's another issue out there. The Ohio General Assembly is going to consider legislation that would require physicians to change the course of an ectopic pregnancy, insert the fetus or the, this has been, is this actually going to go anywhere, you guys?
Well, it wouldn't require it. It would make, there's a bill that would make performing or having an abortion murder.
Right.
And one of the exceptions would be, it's like you would not be charged with murder if this sort of procedure was carried out. The problem is that almost the entire medical community says this is not a possible thing. It's just complete fiction. And the sponsors say, these were citations in medical journals in, 1917 and 1990 or something. And, the sponsor says he didn't really do any research on the bill.
Yeah. Was it the Cincinnati Inquirer that reported that he just took it on face value and never even looked into it?
Yes.
The Cincinnati Inquirer, I think it was Jesse Ballmert, had the story about how Barry Sheets, who's kind of like this longtime state house lobbyist on the Christian conservative areas, that he advised John Becker, a very conservative lawmaker from Clinton County?
Claremont,
okay. And then he amended that bill to put in this ectopic pregnancy transplant exception, which is not a thing. It is cited in two cases. One was from 1917.
This is when the egg
implants in the tube, in the fallopian tube.
It can
be deadly.
It's biggest problem with it is
it poses a deadly risk to the mother.
Right. Mm.
So yeah, if it's part of the bill to make abortion a capital murder, then I don't believe it's going to go anywhere. But I think, and we've talked about this on the show before, Anne, about, you know, we used to talk about the most extreme abortion bill in the state house was the so-called heartbeat bill or the 6-week abortion ban. And so for years and years, we would talk about that being sort of like
the outer edge. Limits. Yeah.
And now that has passed. So now we end up talking about what could be next when it comes to abortion restrictions. And so this is now the bill we talk about. But when it comes to, does it really have a chance to pass? I don't believe so in this legislature. If you were to talk to Governor Mike DeWine, he even says, let's put a pause on the abortion restriction bills and wait to see what happens with the so-called heartbeat bill. Again, that's a bill that bans an abortion as soon as six weeks. He wants to see what the courts do with that, to see if the courts actually uphold that as something constitutional.
And that is being lit. I mean, there it is put on hold while it's litigated, but that could be years, Laura Bischoff. Or
yeah,
is
I
it
mean,
farther this, along?
Yeah, the 6-week ban is on hold. So is the Down syndrome, the 2017 law that would ban an abortion after diagnosis of Down syndrome has been made, and that. I think the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed to do a full panel hearing on that. So yeah, there's a bunch of restrictions that are already in the judicial pipeline, if you will. And I think that there's a lot of people in the legislature that for them it's absolute that abortion, mm-hmm. all abortion at all levels is murder, and they would like to see laws to
right.
Express that. This is also tied into, Ohio is the only state in the nation without health standards that describe for K-12 students what they should learn about nutrition and healthy choices and mental health and also sex education. And there's a bill pending in the Senate Education Committee, Vernon Sykes and Stephanie Kunze. It's a bipartisan bill that would direct the State Board of Education to adopt health standards for everything except sex education. They realize that they just have to sidestep that whole issue because it's just too controversial for the lawmakers to deal with. And actually, it was back in, I think, like 1998 or 99 that the lawmakers found that Ohio had gotten this big grant from the CDC to do comprehensive sex education, and some of the lessons were too explicit for conservative lawmakers' comfort zones, and so they gave the grant back, and then they passed a law that requires General Assembly, like a joint resolution approving the health standards, any health standards that the State Board of Education come up with, and that's why for more than 20 years we have not had health standards, and we are the only state without them.
We're going to take a break. This is our weekly reporter roundtable on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. The impeachment proceedings are expected, they're expected to vote on impeachment in the U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday. That's the latest we have on that. But wow. I mean, if one of the things people are talking about isn't Jim Jordan, I'd be shocked. They call him, was it Jacketless Jim, representative from Ohio representing
the 4th Congressional District.
4th Congressional
District,
shaped like a duck. Mm-hmm. Apparently spans from Cleveland to
all the way down near Springfield.
Springfield.
Near Springfield.
He hails from Urbana or in that area. And apparently he's aggravating enough money, enough people that it's generating revenue or campaign funds for his opponent, and there's a lot of enthusiasm on that score, but...
There's a lot of enthusiasm in that district for Jim Jordan.
Jim Jordan,
he won. He, I think, last time I
checked,
and
that's the way they drew it.
And he won that district by, I think, 65%.
Yeah,
he is a vociferous supporter of Donald Trump, and he has been one of the main attack dogs against impeachment on the House
Intelligence. Considered the most loyal,
right? So much so that he's gotten parodies on SNL,
right?
Mm-hmm. But he's on the he was. I think temporarily put on the House Intelligence Committee,
yep,
and then he's on the House Judiciary Committee,
mm-hmm.
and so he's gotten a lot of...
He goes wherever the action goes.
Yeah, so he's had a lot of TV time, and, you know, his argument is there's no impeachable offense because the military, the almost $400 million in military aid was released before the Ukrainians knew that there was a hold on it, and that Donald Trump was testing... the new Ukrainian president Zelensky to see if he was the real deal against corruption.
And was the result, did anybody promise to do an investigation in order to get the money released? And he sort of drilled down on those points when the witnesses took the stand as well. And you know, and like you said, nationally or the issues that we seem to see blow up on social media and on Twitter, it would seem to tell you that there's a lot of people who are against somebody like Jim Jordan in his district. But like what everybody just said, when you actually go into his district and talk to the people who actually matter and the voters that actually have a say in this, this is a district that will likely strongly support Jim Jordan, no matter how much money flows into his opponent.
And not just Republicans. There's a lot of support for Jim Jordan in that district. He's a known person around. There's a lot of people who personally—
Yeah, he's been around for a long time, for 30 years. Like, I mean, starting with the Ohio General Assembly and maybe before that locally.
Yeah, actually, he was one of the—you know, hearkening back to that health education standards discussion, he was one of the people who wanted to put General Assembly— control over how the health standards look.
Yeah, I mean, he's the person who's known for, again, WOSU's Nick Evans did a whole piece on Jim Jordan and went to his district and talked to his supporters and discovered that Jim Jordan's somebody who's known to go to every local fair and festival. He's known to shake every hand. So he's not just somebody who's built up a large nationwide public profile, but he is somebody who's been there for so long who people just know him. You're right, Jeremy, not just as the Republican congressman, but as Jim Jordan.
Does he have aspirations beyond Congress? Of course, don't
if he has, I haven't heard about him.
Yeah, but yeah, nothing concrete.
I mean, perhaps within Congress.
Leadership.
You know, leadership, but not, I haven't heard of any national aspirations for him.
He's one of the co-founders of the Freedom Caucus, which is sort of the very conservative wing of the Republicans in the House. And I think that the Freedom Caucus, you know, kind of gave fits to John Boehner when he was Speaker.
John Boehner of Ohio. So it doesn't matter. There's really not enough money to beat Jim Jordan
and
in
enough
his own
voters.
District. Yeah, right.
I mean, when it comes down to it.
Exactly. Jennifer Bruner has filed paperwork to run for the state Supreme Court. She is a former Ohio Secretary of State. She's now serving as 10th District Court of Appeals judge here in Columbus. In her press release, the second sentence noted that the Ohio Supreme Court is poised to review challenges of new district maps drawn after the 2020 census, putting the stakes front and center on this. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, right now it's a 5-2 majority for Republicans on the Supreme Court. Bruner is running in one of two Republican-held seats. And if Democrats win both of those, it's a 4-3 Democratic majority heading into redistricting season. So it's she's running for Judy French's seat. And then Sharon Kennedy is being opposed by John O'Donnell from Cuyahoga County.
And Judy French has been, I think she was a 10th District Court of Appeals judge before she made it to the Supreme Court. She served as, I think, legal counsel to Bob Taft. So she's the Republican. And then Sharon Kennedy is from, I think, the Middletown area, is a former police officer, has been on the court for quite some time. The Supreme Court, there's so much voter fall off. They don't really pay attention to it. They run with partisan labels in the primary, but not in the general election. The Supreme Court is kind of a big deal. They decide election issues, open records issues, gerrymandering, insurance, insurance policies and interpretations.
And it's sort of infamous because there's a tradition there for some weird reason of people with an Irish last name getting elected. Mm-hmm. The thing that comes to mind is a few years
or
ago.
Or the name Brown.
There was Bob Cupp, who was a sitting Supreme Court justice, a Republican, and he spent more than $1 million, but he lost to a guy named Bill O'Neill, who spent, I think, what, $25, something like that? Like,
had the support of his own party, I think.
And barely had the support of his own party. But when people are looking down the ballot, they don't know who these people are. They're like, oh, I like that name. I don't even see a party label. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to vote for whomever. And it can be really hard to predict these races because of that.
And I believe sitting Justice Yvette McGee Brown lost to Sharon Kennedy.
Correct.
These O'Neills and Kennedys and
McGee Brown, not Brown. So
that's right. Yeah, it just happens to be the name game. And there are some people out there who want a party label attached to the candidates who run for Supreme Court. There's arguments for and against that. But
that would be a constitutional amendment. Set forth?
I don't know.
I'm not sure. Okay. People sort of point to the name game as a reason to include party labels because maybe there's some sort of psychology that mm-hmm. goes along with it. There has to be.
But, keep in mind that the Democrats only have three statewide elected Democrats in office, Sherrod Brown and then the two on
State
the
Senator, and, I mean, and then U.S. Senator. Yep.
U.S. Senator. And then the two on the Supreme Court, Mike Donnelly and Melody Stewart, are the only three statewide elected Democrats. The Republicans hold all the other offices.
The governor has said now, we've talked about the death penalty recently, and he now is kind of taken another step. It was just on hold. Mm-hmm. Now, Laura Bischoff, what's the distinction? What's the latest iteration of this?
Well, it's interesting. The director of DRC, Annette Chambers-Smith, said earlier this month that she had sent some recommendations to the governor regarding new lethal injection protocol, how to secure drugs, etc. She wouldn't go into the details of that. I think the governor is still worried that the pharmaceutical companies that make these drugs, they oppose having their drugs used for executions. And there's been some indication that they would withhold the sale of drugs to Ohio institutions such as the mental health hospitals.
Or Medicaid.
Or Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be kind of a big problem. Tomorrow, the Death Penalty Information Center is releasing its 2019 report on the death penalty in Ohio. So stay tuned for details on that.
It's just an ongoing issue. Ohio has had problems for years with getting these drugs, and they're just trying to find a combination of drugs that will pass constitutional muster, not have problems, but they are able to buy them. And the governor, when you ask him, like, what do you think about the death penalty? He says, well, it's the law, and I'm going to follow the law, which is not exactly a ringing endorsement, but he stopped short of saying, like, I oppose the death penalty. He's a former prosecutor. He has, in the past, supported the death penalty.
He voted for it in 1981.
Yeah, he sure did.
When he was a member of the Ohio General Assembly, yeah.
So it's a big question now, and to the point that some lawmakers and the governor himself have raised the issue of finding a different execution method from lethal injection.
It's interesting. The Associated Press had a little conference with statewide office holders. I think it was in February. And at that time, we had asked the governor questions about the death penalty, and he did not give any kind of a ringing endorsement of it and actually seemed to be hesitant or kind of cool to it. And then since then, he's delayed six executions, mostly because they had a federal court ruling saying that the protocol could be cruel and unusual, and then they've had this big problem with just securing the drugs.
We are sort of getting to the point where the death row inmates who are slated for execution, their execution date keep, like Laura just said, keeps getting moved and moved and moved and moved. At some point, I think we have seen precedent in the past for attorneys to say that that in and of itself is sort of cruel and unusual to say that somebody's going to be executed on one day and constantly move it. So I wonder if and when the next round of delays comes, we might start to hear talk of the kind of treatment that these death row inmates who have been convicted of murder and heinous crimes, but the kind of treatment that they are facing throughout these delays.
Sure, because there's one guy on death row alone who has had his sentence pushed back and rescheduled twice this year alone by the governor, and it just keeps pushing it back and pushing it back.
There's 140 inmates on Ohio's death row. You know, it's interesting. The governor, you know, he voted for the death penalty, the capital punishment law, before we had access to DNA analysis that has led to exonerations, including a couple of men on Ohio's death row. Come to mind.
He has other interests in the criminal justice system as well. He is put together a panel to look at the idea of expedited pardons.
Yeah, that's a really interesting project. This is something that Ohio State University Law School and University of Akron Law School are going to participate in, and they'll it may be expanded to other law schools. But essentially, the governor said that he looks at the several hundred applications for pardons or clemency. Clemency is either a pardon or a commutation or a reprieve. It's a power within the Ohio Constitution given to the governor. It's pretty extraordinary. Anyway, the governor looks at the list and he just says, you know, like most of these people are not going to get a pardon. They're just not. They haven't shown a worthy argument for it. But there are 2 million Ohioans who have criminal convictions on their records, misdemeanors and felonies. And the idea would be to have put the word out to all these people that, like, if you apply and you apply through this expedited pardon project, law students will help you fill out your application, make sure it's all complete. And the governor is looking at, Jeremy, you were at the press conference. Was it 10 years? You have to be 10 years away from your conviction. It can't be like...
Yeah, you can't be in prison. You have to have served your sentence and be at least 10 years
in the clear.
Out and have nothing more than like a minor traffic
ticket. Why is this important?
It's important because oftentimes people can wait years, and while this is happening, they run into problems with, for example, the first man from the Dayton area that the governor pardoned, he was trying to get to become a mortgage loan servicer in Georgia, but he couldn't because he had this drug trafficking charge, a conviction from the 90s. And since then, since his release, he has a clean criminal record. And the governor said, well, you know, we shouldn't let this hinder. There's people who have problems getting housing, getting jobs. And the governor's saying, well, if you're a model citizen after this, we shouldn't let this be on your back for the rest of your life.
It's a huge drag on the economy when you think about it. If you have all these people with criminal convictions, and it's just more difficult for them to climb up the ladder of economic success and get better jobs, and professional licensing is a big issue. So the governor has said that you got to be 10 years away from your conviction, no other criminal troubles, you know, other than like a minor traffic ticket. He wants to see documentation that you've had employment or a good reason why you haven't been employed, maybe some volunteer community work. And there's only a handful of other states, I think Connecticut, one of the Dakotas, that have started this expedited pardon project kind of thing. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Meanwhile, lawmakers are looking at changing criminal drug sentencing to see what kind of drug possession charges they could maybe move from a low-level felony to a misdemeanor. And so I think that part of the discussion is if the state's going to do that to help reduce these sentences further into the future, then what can we be doing for the people who did have to serve that time for those sentences in the past? What can we do for them to help them get a fair chance at employment and housing in the future?
We're out of time. I want to thank you guys for joining us today. As always, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, thank you for joining us.
Super fun.
And Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. And Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter, thanks to you.
Thanks, Ann.
And I hope you have a happy holiday, too, as well.
Yeah,
thanks.
Back at you.
Thank you. All right. That's it. for today. This has been our weekly reporter roundtable and All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.